You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
We're seeing a rise in overdose deaths in the Bay Area this year, and a lot of them are caused by fentanyl. This is a crisis that goes beyond California, though. It's being felt by the whole country. And everyone from local to national leaders are committed to bringing this fentanyl epidemic to an end. The Biden administration announced on International Overdose Awareness Day this past week that it's providing $450 million in new funding to tackle this issue. But why has fentanyl taken over the drug landscape? What makes it so deadly, and what more can be done to combat its hold in our world? Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Mary Hughes. To help us take a closer look at the fentanyl crisis, I'm turning to Dr. Chelsea Shover, assistant professor at the UCLA School of Medicine and co-author of a 2020 study on fentanyl's spread to the West Coast. Dr. Shover, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Great. Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, you know, obviously this is a fairly big and intense topic. I was looking at some details coming out of San Francisco from the director of health there, where he was saying that 80% of overdose deaths so far in 2023 are now caused by fentanyl. To me, that seems like things are still very dire when it comes to this situation. So I want to get first your perspective on, you know, what are you seeing in the work that you do? And, you know, is a number like that shocking at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say that, yes, we're still very much in the thick of the worst drug overdose crisis we've seen in the United States and Canada as well, and in a limited way, other parts of the world. And fentanyl is now implicated in the majority of overdose deaths. So hearing that it's present in 80% of overdose deaths in San Francisco is not surprising to me. It's certainly alarming and troubling, but it's not surprising just given how strong and cheap and available fentanyl has become.
Well, and that's part of what I think about, you know, any stories that I hear that are dealing with fentanyl and its reach, I suppose, into the world, is that, you know, this is something that there are people who are seeking out that specifically, but then there are people who are, they're getting fentanyl without even knowing that that's something that they're getting. And, you know, how we hear that that's very prevalent, but just how prevalent is it for fentanyl to show up in something that people just, that's not what they were initially looking for?
Yeah, so that's it's an interesting question. It's complicated, and it depends on what type of drugs. So it is absolutely true that a lot of people do seek fentanyl out. And when I'm thinking about fentanyl being in somewhere or being somewhere that people aren't expecting it, I'm mostly thinking about counterfeit pills. This has particularly been the case here on the West Coast, where pills that look like oxycodone or Xanax or other pharmaceutical products actually contain or are entirely made of fentanyl. To a lesser extent, we have also seen instances of contamination with a small amount of fentanyl ending up in drugs like cocaine, which I tend to think is often a cross-contamination issue if they're being packaged and sold or manufactured in the same places. It's mostly, I think it's mostly unintentional. And then the other issue we see is sometimes, unfortunately, people mistakenly hand off or sell a bag of something that the person buying it thinks it's going to be cocaine, but it's just they've mixed up the white powders and it's actually fentanyl. And so that's not, you know, that's a different issue. The thing with overdose deaths, though, is that in many cases, we aren't able to determine what the person thought they were taking. With non-fatal overdose, that's possible, you know, to ask people. That's not something that we historically have done a great job of collecting data about, though. So we don't have a really good sense. And there's kind of a few different places that we can get a sense of what's in the drug supply as far as that relates to what people are taking and what people think they're taking. So one area is, you know, we're talking about deaths with overdose deaths. You can get some idea from death data, but again, because we can't be sure whether someone took fentanyl intentionally or thinking it was something else, death data is pretty limited in that way. Seizure data from like law enforcement seizures when, you know, there's an arrest or a drug bust and they test the drugs to find out what they're in. You know, when we start seeing products like cocaine or heroin that have been seized and are found to contain some fentanyl, that tells us that, okay, there's some either intentional lacing or cross-contamination happening. And the same thing absolutely with counterfeit pills. And then the third way that we get good information about what is in the drug supply, what people are taking versus what people are intending to take versus what they're ending up taking, is through community-based drug checking. The idea being that someone has a drug that they're planning to use, they bring it to a service that, or they do it at, or they can do it at home with test strips and check the contents. And so for fentanyl, we have fentanyl test strips, which are super easy to use. They work very well. They're very good at finding fentanyl when it's there. So those are helpful because that we're able to ask people when they bring a drug sample, what do you think it is? And then we test it and we can either confirm that it's what the person thinks, or if there's a surprising ingredient, we can let them know. And if there's something that's going to have a dramatically different effect, it's really good to be able to give people that information so they can stay safe and make healthier choices for themselves, basically.
Has it mostly been a positive response to these drug checks, these fentanyl drug checks?
Drug checking, at least as it exists currently in most places in the U.S. that do it, it's part of that package of harm reduction services that are often delivered in a syringe program or maybe at events like festivals or concerts potentially. And the response is generally pretty positive in the sense that even when people don't have any drugs they want to check that day, you know, usually people are saying like, I'm glad this is a resource. I'm glad we can do this so we can have more knowledge about what we're taking and we can have a better idea of that. The reception has been pretty positive. I think that things like the test strips, though, are really, really promising for people who don't want to take fentanyl. But I think, you know, one of the big messages is, or one of the big lessons of the last few years is that many people are using it intentionally. And it's really easy, because it's such a strong drug, it's easy for a small error in dosing to make the difference between an expected high versus an overdose. And so technology like fentanyl test strips, really well received for people who are trying not to use fentanyl, not as useful for people who are using fentanyl on purpose. And, you know, we don't have a good way for people to be able to check the strength of their fentanyl or the potency. And so we have seen, you know, there's been some research that's shown that as a particularly strong batch hits an area, you see overdose deaths go up. And that's just because even, you know, even a really small variation can have a much stronger effect in including death for people. I guess that's a long way to say broadly, I think the reception to drug checking has mostly been pretty positive. I think it potentially means that they don't know. We certainly see that in environments like the East Coast of the US, where the drug supply is very complex. Somewhere like San Francisco or Los Angeles, where I'm based, the drug supply here is just, it's often a few years behind other parts of the country. So we look at where we are now and we you know, say that at least like with the program that I'm running in LA, and I think anecdotally, this is broadly pretty true in other parts of California, is for the most part, we're not finding a lot of unexpected results. But when you, if you look, you want to project out a few years, I think it stands to reason that we could end up seeing more, a drug supply that's more like what we have on the East Coast, where it's like very, there's just a lot of novel substances emerging or combinations or benzodiazepines, just like different things getting mixed in. And we've seen a little bit of that here, but just not as much as other places. So I think drug checking in the context of, you know, San Francisco or Los Angeles, it's important now, and I think it will become more important if and when the drug supply here becomes more complex like it is in much of the rest of the country.
It sounds like the potential is already there for us to end up seeing stronger or more complex versions of fentanyl, of this drug. You know, but what is it about fentanyl that makes it so deadly? You know, what happens when a person takes this that makes it so dangerous?
What makes fentanyl so deadly is that it is so strong in terms of potency by weight. You know, I think the estimates are something like 50 to 100 times stronger than heroin. But what that means in practice is you might have a little pinch of heroin, and to get the same effect, you need a much smaller amount of fentanyl. And because it's so strong, variations in purity can make a huge difference. So if we're talking about like microgram type quantities, potentially that, you know, microgram, milligram, very small units of measurement quantities that can make a difference. And with a product of totally unknown purity, you can't know. I mean, there was a billboard campaign here in Los Angeles that says like 2 milligrams is all it takes. And it's like, well, yeah, that can be true, but it can be a lot less than 2 milligrams for someone to have a fatal overdose with fentanyl if the fentanyl is strong and if that person has a low tolerance. So there's just all these different factors that overlap. The same amount and the same strength of fentanyl can be deadly for someone who has never or not recently used opioids, but then someone who uses opioids every day could take that same amount, same strength, no problem. So even beyond like the factors of the drug, there's a lot of individual factors. The other thing that makes fentanyl such a big factor in overdose deaths is that it's just very easy to make to synthesize compared to something like heroin, which is a naturally derived product. You basically need a poppy field to make heroin. For fentanyl, you just need a lab. And so it's a lot cheaper to make. And because it's so strong, you can make a large amount of product, keep it in a small space. It can be a lot lower profile to manufacture large quantities.
Well, since it is something that is cheaper to make, you don't need some huge factory necessarily to store it or to create it. You know, does that dictate at all who uses fentanyl or play a role in who has access to this drug?
We have historically in the United States done a pretty core job of measuring drug use. And so, you know, some tools we've used in the past, like surveys, like household surveys, those are not very good ways to measure things like use of heroin or fentanyl. Certainly, when we look at who is dying from fentanyl overdose, we start to see disparities there. We see people experiencing homelessness make up a disproportionate number of people dying from fentanyl overdose. Fentanyl use is also something that is very visible as a component of unsheltered homelessness in Los Angeles and San Francisco as well. And that, you know, that demands specialized efforts as far as outreach and providing services and, you know, really working on a very complex issue, because, you know, I guess both something like a fentanyl use disorder and homelessness are both incredibly challenging problems. And when you layer them on together for someone, that just adds to the complexity of, well, what do you do first? Do you help someone get we want to help people get housing because it's very hard to stick to treatment if they're not in housing. But if you just do housing without treatment, like that's not going to help somebody's addiction. And if you, you know, it's the approach of having housing where we can have a more harm reduction approach to drug use, where we are providing, I mean, certainly at minimum, it's like, right, for anyone who's using fentanyl, whether they're using it on purpose or incidentally or accidentally, the key response is to have naloxone and to make Narcan available in terms of, well, so naloxone, brand name Narcan, but there's other manufacturers now. So the key thing is to have naloxone accessible to people who are at risk for an opioid overdose. That's a key thing in terms of preventing death. But then stepping back up the chain, and as far as, say, treating a substance use disorder, we have several medications that are approved for treatment of opioid use disorder, which includes fentanyl use disorder. It can be challenging to start someone on those treatments, just because I think the other thing about fentanyl that makes it different from other opioids like heroin is that someone needs to use it more often to stay well, to avoid having withdrawals. So that makes it very challenging to start someone on treatment. And so those challenges are even more magnified when it's somebody who's trying to start treatment, but also, say, living on the street, because opioid withdrawal is an extremely unpleasant feeling. It's like the worst flu you've ever had. And going through that while you're also living unsheltered is really, really hard and painful. And so having to go through some amount of that, or even just the fear of having to do that, is a real barrier to getting treatment in that setting. I think the other, you know, as far as what other kinds of disparities we see in terms of fentanyl overdose deaths, is we've seen in the last few years the rates among Black and African Americans really rising. That's certainly true in San Francisco, and that's true, you know, across the United States. The rates have historically been highest among American Indian, Alaska Natives, and white non-Hispanics, but just in the last few years, the rates among Black and African Americans have increased. I think one of the important things is to know that as we're moving into what we call this fourth wave of the overdose crisis, the demographics of who is dying are changing in that way.
So with all the work and the research that you've done, you know, if we're here in this, as you put it, this fourth wave of the overdose crisis, which of course goes beyond fentanyl, but you know, this is a big part of what we're focusing on in this conversation, is this particular drug. You know, what more can be done across the board to try to stop another wave coming through?
What more can we do? That's a great question. So one thing, and I think that International Overdose Awareness Day is a really good opportunity to highlight one aspect of what more we can do that I don't think has gotten as much attention. So certainly, you know, we have things like naloxone to prevent death. We have treatment to treat opioid use disorder. We have all of the kinds of social programs and positive life circumstances that can contribute to resiliency for people to either avoid developing a substance use disorder or not engage in problematic substance use or to recover from a substance use disorder. You know, things that promote employment and family connections and, you know, just people having resources and all the other kinds of health services of, you know, mental health treatment, just all the different things that help make people's lives better and more stable and thus less likely to have the negative consequences of substance use, basically. But one thing, you know, so sorry, let me try this again. One thing that International Overdose Awareness Day makes me think of that we don't talk about as much in terms of what we can do more is really honoring the difficulty and the ongoing trauma of working in this field for the people who are on the front lines of working in harm reduction, doing outreach, working in homeless services, working in substance use treatment, and working in, you know, medical first responder, anyone who's responding to overdose, who's working with people to prevent overdose, has likely, you know, most people have lost loved ones to overdose, and as well as the other things that go along with that, you know, the other kinds of violence and structural problems that go with that. So I think, you know, thinking about how do we take care of the people who are really doing the work here? And part of that, you know, I mean, part of it, a huge part of it, I think maybe the most important part of it is really valuing that and valuing that with dollars in terms of paying people who are doing things like case management, you know, making roles that are really helping people get out, you know, helping people, these helper roles that aren't necessarily very highly compensated. And, you know, yeah, like pay case managers more. That's, I think, a huge thing, because helping one person, reduce or stop using a drug like fentanyl, or enter recovery from a substance use disorder is an extraordinarily hard task. And the fact is, a lot of times the people who are on the front lines of that are folks who have themselves had that experience with a substance use disorder. And, you know, because of all the different things that go along with that, like involvement in the criminal legal system, often have fewer jobs available to them. And so it's kind of this question of, you know, do I get the kind of job that I can get with, you know, the background or employment history or incarceration history I might have? Or do I get this job where I'm potentially re-traumatizing myself again and again, trying to help other people get out of this sort of situation? And I think the real material thing we need to do is invest in that workforce development and invest in the people who are out there on the front lines saving lives. And, you know, we do an okay job of that in terms of some medical professions, but we really don't in terms of the folks who are doing case management or who are doing street outreach. And even, you know, even roles like emergency medical services. So just when we're thinking about like front lines of overdose crisis, how do we take care of the people who are taking care of people? And then, yeah, I don't know. That's the one thing I think that we don't talk about as much, because this is a very hard job and we're in it for, you know, we're all in it for the long haul, and we need to make sure that people can keep, you know, doing this work of helping other people survive.
I think that type of acknowledgement of the work that people do and what compensation means is such a big part of a conversation that we've been having ever since the pandemic hit in 2020. And it can be extended into these crisis situations when it comes to the drug crisis that we face here in America. Dr. Shover, thank you so much for speaking with me on all this.
Great. Thanks for having me.
International Overdose Awareness Day was on August 31st, and if you are looking for information on how to recognize an overdose, on what life-saving products there are out there that can reverse an overdose from opioids, you can go to the CDC website, that's cdc.gov, and look for drug overdose /awareness/IOAD. That'll give you lots of good information that could help save a life. You can find this episode and past episodes of In Depth online at kcbsradio.com. Just check the podcast tab and look for KCBS In Depth. You can also hear the episodes on the Odyssey app. Download the app on your smartphone and favorite KCBS radio. Thanks for listening. For KCBS and In Depth, I'm Mary Hughes.
Listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.